From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome back to the China in the World podcast. Today, I'm fortunate to be joined by three Carnegie colleagues, Dmitry Trenin, Alexander Gabuev, and Jean Rumer. Listeners of the podcast will recall last year during our Carnegie Global Dialogue on China-Russia, we heard both from Dmitry and Alex. And this year, we're fortunate to have with us Jean from our Washington, D.C. office. Dmitry is the director of the Carnegie Moscow Center. He's been with the center since its inception in 1994. Alex is a senior fellow and runs the Russia and the Asia Pacific program and is the inaugural chair for that program. Jean, as I mentioned, is director of Carnegie's Russia and Eurasia program in the Washington, D.C. office. Dmitry, Alex, Jean, thank you for being here this week for our Carnegie Global Dialogue, looking at China-Russia issues and the U.S. dynamic. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be back.
Delighted to be here.
Yesterday, we sat down with Chinese scholars. Today, we've met with business officials. You've talked to students, diplomats, ambassadors, and we're looking at the China-Russia relationship primarily. Dmitry, I want to start with you. I mean, you just published your new book called Russia. In the book, you look at the twists and turns of Russia over the past 120 years. Cover a lot in that book, and the outlook for Russia today as well. And so I encourage our listeners to pick up a copy. But Dmitry, given you've done this deep dive recently on Russia's history, I wanted to start our podcast discussion out here asking you to set the context for our discussions and give us a sense of the state of Russian domestic and foreign policy. What are the priorities, and how does China fit into it, and also the U.S.?
Paul, first of all, thank you very much for this invitation, and thank you for this little advertisement regarding the book. I would say that Russia is slowly moving to the end of an era, of a long era, 20 years long, and will be, and counting, will continue for some time. That is the era of Vladimir Putin. And if I were to summarize the issue that gets the most attention in Russia, I would say it's 2024, the year when Putin's presidential mandate is due to expire, and then what? Mm-hmm. Then there are all sorts of scenarios being talked about, and I'm sure that the president and the people around him are drafting plans and scenarios and whatever. But any student of Russian history would probably agree that the most important thing in Russia is political transition. Mm-hmm. And it's never easy. And it's not going to be like it was in 2008 when Putin left the Kremlin for a period of time, always having an option to come back. Whether he wanted to come back after 4 years initially is an open question.
This is when Dmitry Medvedev stepped in as president, and
yes,
Putin stepped back as prime minister, as premier. But
he stepped up, let's say.
Yeah. But in terms of the power that he wielded.
But mm-hmm. he remained the paramount leader of Russia. Yeah. So we're not going to see a repeat of that situation. When Putin leaves the presidency, he is not coming back, I don't think. Russian presidential mandates are 6 years long. And next time there will be an election, he will be about 78.
But even if he doesn't come back, is your sense that he'll still play a very influential role?
I think that he will continue playing the role of the the paramount leader of Russia, the center of authority, the arbiter in chief, but giving more and more authority, giving more and more responsibilities to the people whom he has reared and whom he has brought to the top echelon of Russian government.
Rough analogy in China, maybe a Deng Xiaoping type.
Without
the formal titles, but with yielding the power.
In Russia, a formal title of some sort would be necessary, in my view, because the cultures are different. And there are all sorts of possibilities or options. I don't think we need to go into that, but that's what really captivates so many minds. It's not just the political transition. There is also a feeling that the political economic system that was established under Putin is also running its course and needs at least a major overhaul, and very likely eventually a replacement with a different kind of system, because the present one does not allow Russia to develop, does not allow Russia to have economic growth, does not satisfy Russian people's needs for justice and fairness and many other things. And as we are focused so much on Putin and the Kremlin and the elites, we also need to keep in mind the feelings of the vast majority of Russians. They have very different plans. They have very different views. They're less worried about the political transition.
Mm-hmm.
They're more worried about jobs, about living standards that have been falling recently, a chance to do better for their kids, all sorts of things that, in my view, converges certainly to a new juncture and potentially to a new beginning.
Interesting. And on the foreign policy front, what are the important things in terms of setting the context for the discussion this week and on our podcast that are important to, in your mind?
Foreign policy is widely seen as Putin's major area of achievement. And I would say that many of the achievements of the Putin era would have to be preserved by the next generation of Russian
mm-hmm.
leaders.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are certain things that that hamper Russia's both economic situation and its international position. And these things will have to be addressed. One is a confrontation with the United States. It will probably last quite some time. But the degree of competition, the degree of rivalry is important. Right where we sit right now, Russia and the United States, is a very precarious position. Essentially, the bilateral agenda is down to one question. And that question is basically how to prevent a direct collision between the two countries, a direct military collision between the two countries. So preventing war has become the overriding issue in the relationship. This is how much we have fallen in terms of the bilateral relationship. So on the security front, the United States is the most important issue. On the economic front, the most important issue next to the United States, the sanctions and all that, is the broken relationship with Europe. Europe used to be the principal source of Russian modernization, technology, investment, what have you. And because of the crisis that erupted in 2014 over Ukraine, but of course it has much deeper roots than Ukraine, much of that has been constrained. There's a lot of mutual suspicion, a lot of bad blood between Russians and Europeans. Of course, varying degrees within Europe of suspicion or friendliness toward Russia. But in general, the relationship is broken, and that has to be improved, repaired, in order to give Russia a better chance of using the international economic system to its own benefit.
So you've talked about the U.S., you've talked about Europe, You said yesterday your phrase was all quiet on the Western Front. Really not
quiet
a lot,
meaning frozen.
Lot basically. Frozen, not a lot going on there. But right. Then you talked about other areas like Syria, Africa, and then even the China relationship. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that before I turn to Alex to talk China-Russia.
Well, Russia has basically defined itself as a non-Western country.
Mm-hmm.
It tried after the fall of the Soviet Union desperately at times to become part of the West, become integrated into the Western system. It failed. Now it has pivoted not so much to Asia as to itself, so it stands there as a unit which is neither Europe nor Asia, with some global aspirations. But it's essentially a non-Western country. And now that the relationship with Europe has been frozen, the relationship with the United States is confrontational, there's been a lot more time given to non-Western directions of Russian foreign policy. Mm-hmm. That includes the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always by design. The Middle East, I would say, is a necessity turned into an opportunity by Putin. Looking at Syria, first of all. But but since Russia did not start with a strategy, start with a need to do something in Syria and the need to project itself as a great power onto American minds, primarily, strategy was not there. But the longer it continues, the deeper Russia becomes involved in Syria, the more it has to deal with the mundane issues, and there are many, of security, ultimately reconstruction in that region. And of course, Russia has learned a lot from its experience in Syria. So far, it has been more successful than, much more successful than unsuccessful. Mm-hmm. But I would say the reward for each success is a new challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So the more successful you are, the more challenges you have to deal with, right?
Well, in that context, you know, with frozen relations with the West in general, and an approach to the non-West. So you're doing Russia's doing more in the Middle East. I noticed that Putin met with a number of leaders from Africa recently. I want to turn to Alex. This in your view, what impact does that have on the Russian view of the importance at this particular juncture of its relations with China? We see a growing relationship, clearly, in a number of fronts, political, economic, technological. The relationship is now defined as a comprehensive strategic partnership. For the new era, on the 70th anniversary of bilateral ties. How would you describe the importance of China now, given the context that Dmitry has laid out?
I think there are three elements that define this relationship, regardless of the context and of America's action. Number one is the security at the border. That's the longest continental border that China has with any country. That's the second longest border after Russia's border with Kazakhstan, which is not a real border. So both countries have been in confrontation. They have invested into protection of this border, and they know that confrontation is very dangerous and very expensive. Once they settle the territorial issue and demilitarize this border, the formula in the relationship is not always with each other, but never against each other. That's pillar one. Pillar two is the mutual compatibility of the economies. Russia has abundance of natural resources, needs investment and infrastructure. China is the opposite. And then three are similarities in the political systems. So these three elements are there, but Russia is discovering that China is really playing a very important role in this part of the world, driving demand for commodities, and is actually a power that can balance Russia's at least economic outreach to the outside world and lessen its dependency on Europe. So in an ideal world, you would have Russia standing on two legs or representing a coat of arms, the double-headed eagle, which looks both east and west. And Russia, as an exporter, which is all about commodities, could send its commodities westward to the European Union, and then eastward to China and hopefully other players in Asia. But then the sanctions came in. And I think that the role of China as a market for Russian commodities, as source of advanced technology to replace Western technology, and a source of capital is increasingly visible. So these are the three areas where Russia really needs China on the economic front. And then as a leader of security specialists in the non-Western world, as Dmitry puts it, I think that Russia is increasingly interested in building relationship with China that is also a non-Western power and probably top-tier non-Western power and an alternative pole. Russia doesn't want to be dominated by this pole, but it wants to build a comprehensive relationship. I think that if you look at what China gets out of this relationship, and that's, I think, very important to the listeners, there are a number of things. Number one, this is what China gets in material terms, commodities. Russia is top supplier of crude to China over the last 4 years, and I think that this role is going to continue. Number two is military hardware. And then China is very advanced and getting even more advanced. But there are certain types of hardware that Russia still sells to China that are needed. Putin recently has announced that Russia is helping China to build its early warning system, a crucial component to bring China into the top league of nuclear powers on par with US and Russia. Number three is probably China's Russia's support to China in the UN, and that's still important, that China's voice on sovereignty in the internet or on support for countries like Syria or Myanmar is not alone, but is amplified by friendly member of the Security Council. And then also there is growing interest in tapping into Russian brain power, bringing in Russian engineers into value chains of companies like Huawei in order to probably offset some challenge that Chinese companies are facing in the US and the prospect that they will be completely shut out of the US innovation system. Chinese tech companies really think through of where do they get smart kids that are thinking differently than Chinese smart kids here in Zhongguancun and other campuses.
So clearly, I mean, you've just laid out quite comprehensively what Russia can get out of a growing relationship, what China can get out of a growing relationship. I want to turn to Gene, if I could. You know, at the discussion, the discussions that we've had, especially with our Chinese experts, I wondered, you know, what are the kind of things that you heard from them that struck you about their views of the China-Russia relationship as an American observer?
And not a disinterested one. What I think struck me the most in the conversations in the last few days here with Chinese experts and obviously my Russian colleagues is the degree of perhaps ambivalence, probably not too strong a word, in the expert community about the quality and the benefits of this relationship, meaning Russia-China relationship. While there is this growing mutual admiration society at the highest levels of these two countries' governments, and I have no reason to think that it's not sincere, as some of our colleagues have pointed out, the two leaders share sort of similar generational perspectives and ideological views and so on, but it's interesting to hear from our Chinese colleagues something that one doesn't often hear in Washington in reference to the bilateral Russia-China relationship. That this is not an alliance. We're not looking for an alliance. We're not allies. So there is this desire for very good relations, but also somewhat at arm's length. And if I may bring this conversation to some of the issues that I heard raised on a trip to Moscow earlier this year in June, In the expert community in Moscow, I think there are questions about the direction overall of this relationship. Clearly, there is nobody challenging the high-level growing proximity and quality of relations, but there are questions about, you know, what is Russia getting out of this? That's what I heard in Moscow. How will this ever approaching to each other relationship, how is it going to affect our sovereignty, our ability to preserve Russia as an independent pole in a multipolar system?
You know, I will say that what I was struck by yesterday in hearing the discussion, as I've mentioned to you, is last year when we had the same theme for the discussion, there was much more discussion on an emphasis on the areas where Russia and China are coming together and cooperating, where there's common interest, why the relationship should grow. This year, I heard much more about worries or concerns and limitations, not just from the Chinese experts, but in fact, from Alex. Yesterday, you mentioned some concerns, and I wonder if you would share those about sort of maybe too much dependence on Russia, if you can expand on those concerns that Russia has with regard to the relationship.
Dependence on China.
On China, exactly.
I think the basic characteristics of this relationship now is that it's a mutual interdependence, but it's increasingly asymmetrical. And it's a function of the comprehensive national power and the pace of growth in comprehensive national power, be predominantly about economics and the innovation culture and investment into R&D. So positioning yourself for the future of the economy where AI, biotechnology will play an increasingly important role, and that will be the foundation for your military power. Russia is doing something in that direction, but China has just so much and so many resources being very strategically poured into those areas. If I compare Russia and China here, Russia is probably the size of an iPhone, and China is a giant iPad, like a big tablet that Apple...
What probably, generation iPhone?
Probably X. But China is a giant iPad that probably Apple hasn't brought to the market yet. And then China is growing by the pace of 6% a year. We can debate the figures, but it's in this range. And then Russia is growing 1% a year till 2035, according to the estimates of the Russian government. So that creates a lot of gaps. And as we are entering the next decade, these gaps will only widen. Mm. So as Russia is shunned from Western technological world, from the financial flows, and the sanctions play an important role, but also the toxic cloud around Russia, and then the domestic climate in Russia with a lot of uncertainty generated by the transition, Russia has increasingly to turn to China for financing, for technology, and then is increasingly embedded into what I call Pax Sinica, China-centered geopolitical and geoeconomic framework in Eurasia, where China is setting the standards by the sheer size and sheer pool of China's economy and advancement of Chinese technology. So Russia is risking 10, 15, 20 years ago to find itself so much tied to Huawei universe, to RMB settlement mechanism, unless it finds an alternative and first revitalizes its own economy, and B, finds an alternative in rebuilding its ties to the West and also to American allies in Asia, which is impossible without some sort of repairing U.S.-Russia ties.
So that was a very useful description that on some Russian concerns about an over dependence, frankly, on its reliance with its relationship with China. And as Gene said, we heard from Chinese experts, very clearly. Look, this is a growing relationship. It's important to us, but you know, we're not looking to form an alliance with Russia. And there are limitations. I was struck by the description of one Chinese expert of the difference in his view of how China sees the international system and international order with how Russia, he views Russia as seeing international system and international. He made the point that the international system, from a Chinese perspective, has generally worked well for China. China has obviously grown its economy considerably and has been able to develop in this system. And China is not looking to overturn or overthrow the international system, but would rather modify it to reflect China's growing clout. His view was that Russia perhaps wants to overthrow and the international system, and that Russia uses global chaos to its geostrategic advantage. China doesn't like global disorder. It sees a need for a precondition of stability in the international environment to be able to continue its economic development. And so there was a difference from this Chinese perspective in how China sees the world and how Russia sees the world, and not an insignificant difference. Now, Dmitry, you've called this China-Russia relationship entente. And I think we might be able to find some of the answers to the questions that we're dealing with here in your description, in your use of the word entente. When you say entente between China and Russia, what is it that you're talking about?
Well, basically, it means a high degree of mutual understanding at the strategic level, at the top strategic level of the commonality of some of the core interests of the United States, of China and Russia at this present juncture. Essentially, Entente is about the agreement, empathy that lies at the core of it. I use the term to describe a state of relations which is closer than a strategic partnership, which means, just a good relationship these days, and an alliance, which is not there, and I don't think, I don't think there will be an alliance. I said I hope, because an alliance between China and Russia can only be the result of a deterioration of U.S.-Chinese and U.S.-Russian relations at the same time, to the extent that brings us basically to the brink of war. I hope it never happens. And I think that a formal alliance, a real alliance, will not be sealed between China and Russia. I hear it from the Chinese colleagues. I hear it from the Russians. Actually, there are some Russians who want an alliance, who think that an alliance with China would somehow empower Russia vis-a-vis the United States, but they never think about the price. Well, they never think about two things. They never think about the Chinese, and they never think about the price. And both work very, very effectively against such an alliance. So people who know in Russia emphatically say it's not an alliance, and it's not going to be an alliance. It's a 100% pragmatic relationship, which is close, but which does not constitute a merger of any kind. Now let me just comment very briefly on the different perspectives of on the international system or on the world order, however you want to call it. Some people say China does not want to overturn the system, but it wants to gradually overtake it. And is the United States, or let's say, taking the center position and push the United States a little bit to the sidelines in that order. So it's a very different concept. Russia has no power and has no intention, in my view, to undermine the global order as such. Russia is not about the global order. unlike the Soviet Union, Russia is about its place in the international order, in the global order. It wants to be treated in a certain way. It wants its security interests above all to be taken care of. It doesn't want NATO to come all the way to its borders, and that lies at the core of it. Whether it's the correct or wrong perception of Russian interest, we leave it to one side. It's something that drives Russian foreign policy and strategic thinking. And the decision to ignore it, which I think was very clear in NATO, basically has brought the relationship to where we are today, to confrontation. It was not because Putin or whoever wanted to undermine U.S. power, undermine U.S. Putin said, I think very, very sincerely, when he explained his action in Crimea, he said, we would rather welcome NATO sailors to Sevastopol than to be welcomed by them to Sevastopol. And that's, in a nutshell, that's it. So I think that, of course, China and Russia have very different views on many things, but on some important things of today, there's a degree of commonality, there's a degree of mutuality that allows me to call it entente. And the United States helps in the wrong way by applying pressure simultaneously on China and on Russia, which in my view is not strategic. It helps China and Russia to come closer together than I would say either country would prefer.
On that note, I want to our final question for Gene. And you teed it up nicely, Dmitry, which is, you know, if you look at the U.S. approach, the national security strategy, the national defense strategy now talks about great power relations, the revival of great power relations, and identifies China and Russia as the major threats. And, you know, I wanted to get a sense from you, Gene, on, you know, how closely you think the Trump administration is paying attention to the China-Russia growing relationship. How much is it driving that relationship, the U.S. policy and approach driving that relationship even closer together? And you know, is this, you know, China-Russia growing ties a development in your view that could generally harm U.S. interest? And what should the Trump administration be doing in relation to this?
Look, it's very difficult to talk about U.S. policy these days because it's an election year, or we're approaching our election year. And in any election year, all policymaking tends to be heavily politicized. Mm-hmm. This is a twofer, in a sense, because we have a very charged domestic political atmosphere, plus we have the impeachment process underway. Mm-hmm. And that, to my mind, really reflects a profound split in our society, which didn't just come about in 2016, but actually something that's been building up for some time. Let me just digress for a moment and say that if you think about the international system that some say China wants to own and others say Russia wants to blow up, the international system has been remarkably, remarkably good for all three countries. Russia, China, and the United States. If it hadn't been for the international system and the system of free trade, we probably would not have seen China's rise, which has benefited not only China, but also Russia. The wall of money, to use a term, flowed into Russia in a large measure thanks to the rise of China and the economic development of China early in this century. The United States has benefited tremendously. Now, what each country has done domestically with that wealth and the benefits that have flown to it from the international system is a different story. In the case of the United States, I think we're seeing the side effects of that, of globalization, really taking a heavy toll on our domestic politics. And given the fact that it's an accumulation of side effects over the past 20, 25 years. Hopefully it won't take us 25 years to address them, but it's going to be a significant issue that will affect our relationship with all major powers for quite some time. And frankly, I think the Trump administration and the strategic community in the United States has not really quite come to terms with this concept of competition of major powers. We're still at this inflection point in a large part because we don't quite know how to structure our relationship with Russia, which is, you know, a fraction of our economy, yet plays a disproportionate role in our view on a world stage. And China, which is a peer competitor or a near peer competitor, on which we have grown tremendously dependent. This is a complex problem. It's not going to be solved this year. It's not going to be solved next year. But I am not particularly alarmed by the idea of this growing China-Russia entente or partnership. I think the first task for us is not to worry about what they do, but to really focus on what we want in each of these two relationships beyond just slapping sanctions or imposing tariffs and proceed with that. I think that's the key question for us.
Well, I would agree with that. And I also agree with you that it'll be increasingly difficult over the next year, given the political year that we're moving into. We haven't been able to have that thoughtful debate.
Right.
And I think clearly the U.S.-Russia relationship is in a very bad place. And the U.S.-China relationship is increasingly in a bad place. And as Alex and I were talking before the podcast, I think in the U.S. many observers have concluded, and I think there's some consensus on this issue, that the framework we used with to engage China and to approach China that we used over the last several decades is not going to work, but there's not a consensus on where we go from here and what framework we use now. And that's the debate we need to have.
Let me just add one other thing. So many in Washington worry about this strategic partnership between Russia and China. Now, think about what the picture would have looked if we had strategic competition between the two and what the consequences of a bad relationship between Russia and China would have been for our interests in the Pacific. So let's look for some positives here.
There you go. End it on a positive. Dmitry, Alexander, Gene, thank you very much for joining us this week for the Carnegie Global Dialogue and also for joining the China in the World podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us and thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining the China in the World podcast. Be sure to check out more content from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center on our website.